Okay, let's go through these questions. Number one, here we go. Nothing on it. That's the last question I have. Number two, someone doing walking meditation in the garden farted loudly. Is this breaking the noble silence? No, we just did the chant as a metta sutta, may all beings be happy and well. Okay. Dear Ajahn, thank you for running this retreat and giving us all a great opportunity. At times I become quiet very quickly, where I cannot detect the breath. It is very still here and not pleasant or unpleasant. I'm very alert here. It's like I don't know what it's like. The breath, I have to look for it. When I do, to focus on it seems to bring me down or out of this state. When the breath is quiet and subtle, I can't tell the gap between the in-breath and out-breath. To do this seems to bring me out of this state. Once I'm here, it's like, okay, what's this? Is this correct? Could you please clear this up for me? I don't know if I'm doing the right thing or not. Okay, it's just sometimes that it happens. It's a good sign. You're watching the breath, and then after a while, the breath disappears. It's actually, you will find out if you investigate that state fully. In other words, you are familiar with it. You're actually still watching the breath, but it's the way the mind sees the breath, not the way that the body feels the breath. Remember, you have six senses in this body and mind, and those senses are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and knowing. Feeling the breath is much different than knowing the breath. It's actually experiencing the breath through a different sense door. And so what actually happens very often is you're watching the breath through the feeling door, through the sense of touch. And after a while, when that calms down, then what happens next? You know the breath, but it looks completely different. Some years ago, I gave the simile of like somebody who becomes a monk or who becomes a nun. You take someone like Isabel. She's got long hair, and one day she's going to cut off that hair and become a nun. I hope, aren't you? Very good. And sometimes her friends and relations will come, and they won't recognize her because she's wearing a different colored robe, she has a different hairstyle, she looks very different. Only after a while you look at them and say, oh, I remember you. And it's the same with the breath, that when you just have experienced the breath with a sense of touch, it takes a while when you experience the breath through the sense of mind, just knowing the breath, to recognize, ah, that's the same thing. It's as if its external appearance has changed, but it's still the same breath underneath. So sometimes that happens. But whatever is happening there, when you understand what's happening, it's a good thing. However, that keep with that peacefulness, whatever's happening once the breath disappears, and it should pretty soon turn into a happy state, a joyful state. And it's the joy coming up in the meditation is so important. If that joy isn't happening, sometimes what I sometimes do is actually to increase the focus or sharpen the focus in the present moment. Because I often find that you have present moment awareness in the beginning, but as you go into silence and you start watching the breath, the focus tends to blur a bit and your awareness is smudged over the present moment. There's a little bit of past, there's a little bit of future, but you're not precise. So when I get into at that stage, you're peaceful, the breath is almost disappeared, but you haven't got the intensity of happiness. I just compare it to focusing a lens. You just adjust it slightly to get that sharpness of focus in the present moment. And when you do that, your attention is so finely focused in the present moment, in that silence, it usually will build up its energy and turn into a happiness. And that state of peacefulness is not just dull peacefulness, it's energized peace. So you get some happiness and energy coming up into the mind. If you haven't got that energy in the mind, you can't go further in the meditation. So focusing is a good thing. If you focus and this still doesn't happen, then just wait. Be patient. Because, as I mentioned earlier, and this is an important insight into the way of meditation, as long as you're not doing things, as long as the energy of your being is not being wasted in controlling, changing things, planning, doing something else, as long as you're still, the energy can only go into one place, and that's into mindfulness, into knowing. And as the energy builds up, sometimes in interviews I call it adding piece upon piece upon piece, building up a whole storehouse of contentment. That has to build up in the energy of peace, which is happiness. The mind awakens and becomes bright, and with that brightness, the peace which you see is more deep, it's more powerful, it becomes blissful. And there you get these nimittas and you go into the deep states of meditation. So you've got the tranquility there, the calm now. Now you want to get the energy coming up. And you can either do it one of two ways, either just trying to focus on the present moment, just a slight adjustment so you're not smudged in time, but you're really precise, then all the energy can just go into that one moment. And just be patient and allow the energies to build up and build up until there's a bright peacefulness. That's the best way of going. So if that doesn't make sense, whoever asked that question, come and discuss it in the interview period, because then you can actually get into more understanding of how you're actually feeling at that particular state, whether it is dullness or whether it is just the breath disappearing and you're knowing the breath rather than feeling the breath. Especially if that happens, you've been feeling the breath, you've noticed the breath go in and go out many, many times, and your mindfulness is very, very good, and then it sort of fades away and you get into that state, that's fine, that's a good sign. But if you get into that state very quickly, or you haven't even really been getting to the state of full awareness of the breath yet, then it might be dullness. To find out which one it is, you can just see what happened before, how come that state arose. Is that quite clear? Just the whole path of meditation. There's of letting go and allowing energy to go into mindfulness. That's why later on when you start talking about insight, you know, hopefully for many of you, you'll get in these deep states of meditation, deep enough anyway. You feel just so much energy, so much joy. It's like having 10 cups of coffee, only you haven't had any caffeine at all. It's a natural energy of the mind. And you go outside and just everything just looks so, it's like everything's been polished. Like somebody's gone outside and polished all the leaves and made them more green than you've ever seen before. And the flowers, the colours are just almost like radiant. Whatever you look at, you see so deep and just so fun. You have a big smile on your face and you're so happy. No matter what happens, you just feel like laughing. So that joy and bubbly joy which comes out, that's called kitti, which is an important part of meditation, the inner joy coming up from your meditation. So if it's peaceful, it's great, but it's the joyful peace is what we're supposed to be getting next. Okay, next one. At what level of a meditator can surely manage his last movement of thought when he is dying? Any level of meditation. You can manage the thought because the last moment of meditation, you're desperate. It's amazing what you can do when you're desperate. Sometimes you have to let go, so you do let go. Sometimes when you don't have to, you've got many, many more days left, and maybe I'll do it tomorrow. But the last moment that you really let go. That's why many people become enlightened at the time of their death. Simply because your whole body is disappearing. And all your possessions, you know they're being taken away from you. You know you're not going to have a job to go to tomorrow morning. You don't have a body to take to your job. You know that just all your finances, who cares about it? There's no family left. It's all gone. It's going, and you know it's going. It's great. At last, you've got nothing, no responsibilities anymore. It's a great time when you're dead. You don't have a husband to worry about. You don't have to have a wife. You don't have any financial problems. You don't have to worry about going to work. You don't have to worry about your health anyway. You know, you die, great. You don't have to worry about doctors and medicines anymore. Isn't it a wonderful time? You're absolutely free. any aches and pains in only a few moments and all gone. Oh, what a relief. Dying is like winning the lottery. You get all the problems are solved. So you can just let go at that particular time. It's amazing what you can sometimes do at death. So especially if you know present moment awareness and silence. Isn't that a wonderful thing to do? You're just in this moment and you're silent, you're not thinking at all. You just experience death without giving it a name.
When something adjourns, everything, you die, and if your mind is not still or whatever, couldn't one feel the pain?
No.
You just came off.
Yes. You don't usually feel the pain at that particular stage because the body is just, your mind is almost gone. It's, for those of you who've read the old books, that the last few seconds before you finally die, you don't have any pain at all. There have been many, many cases in the years, the era before palliative care, when people just shot so much morphine into you that you don't feel anything. The people would be in great pain just before they died. But about a few minutes, I forget if it's 3 minutes or 4 minutes on average, before you actually really die, there's no pain at all. You're actually free of pain. I remember first reading about this in a short story by Leo Tolstoy about this fellow in Russia 100 years ago, had this terrible sickness, no one could cure it, tried every type of medicine. The worst thing, he was asleep in the house and he was screaming almost 24 hours a day in agony and pain. And he was describing just what this did to the family. There was, it was their loved one, but they couldn't do anything, and it was awful to see this fellow being tortured by his illness day after day after day. But they sort of got used to the screaming and the groaning and agony. But then one day, it was strange, the agony, the scream stopped. It was absolutely silent, and because that had been going on for many weeks, it was really so eerie and weird. The pain had stopped, and the fellow was perfectly conscious, and about 3 or 4 minutes later, he died. And it's apparently quite common that before the advent of all these drugs, before you died, you'd have the last 2 or 3 minutes of pain-free awareness. Even recently, somebody has said, it was one of the Australians who'd come to our centre, they said they were with their father, who was dying and groaning, and he was almost like in a coma, just at the end, fighting for his breath. And they were just holding his hand by his bedside. And then suddenly he stopped groaning. And he bent up. Now he was lying down, he just bent up and looked with clear eyes. And his two daughters, they said simultaneously, they don't know, they never planned this, they said, "We love you, Dad." And at that, he died. Interesting. So you do, so if you're giving your organs, you don't feel a thing. If anything, you feel happy. Oh, you're making some dana at the very end.
I've donated.
Okay.
But I keep thinking, it might be painful.
No, come on, don't be a donor like that. Just give it no matter what. But I don't know about you, but I suffer from hay fever. So sometimes, do you suffer from hay fever? Oh, can I have your nose? Actually, I wanted an Aboriginal nose, so I have this nice white face with a big black nose in the middle. I thought that'd be really neat. That'd really be multicultural. Anyway, let's go to the next one. Dear Ajahn Brahm, just being in the present moment sounds easy, but without a tether, i.e. the breath, it's almost impossible. The more I relax, the more active my thoughts become. Unless I use some gentle control, friendly of course, I'm always in a flash into past or future. When mindfulness notices this, surely I need to bring the mind back to concentrate on something. Otherwise, it's just a naughty monkey and can drift into a bawanga state. That's almost like sleepiness. Thank you. I persevere with this present moment awareness business because the more you persevere with it, the sooner you become familiar with it. It's a tough ask to be in the present moment, but it's worth the effort. And by the effort, it's not physical force or mental force, it's wisdom power. So first of all, get to know what the present moment is. And just investigate until you become familiar with it. You can feel it, you know it, you understand what we're talking about. And then that is your tether. The present moment. There is a place where you can tie the mind. It's called a present moment. The problem is you're not familiar, you don't exactly know what it is yet, because it's a strange object. But once you have that object, and you understand what it is through familiarity, through repeated experience, then you have a beautiful tether to the mind. If you try and tether it to the present, to the breath, sometimes that's too deep, too soon. And the only way you can tie it there, and you get very tense. Whoever asked this one, if you really want to and you're having a hard time, okay, tether to the breath, maybe every other meditation. And the ones in between, see if you can investigate present moment awareness. Find out what it really is. Get a feel for it. When you get a feel for it and you understand what it is, that is your tether. That's where you put the mind. Look, what's the past? What's the future? You know those two? If you've eliminated everything to do with the past and everything to do with the future, and you've eliminated fantasy, then everything left is what we call the present moment. So play around, investigate, give yourself mental exercises. I'm not going to be in the past, I'm not going to be in the future, I'm not going to fantasize. What's left? That has to be the present moment. This experience of now. And keep on practicing that way until you get to know what we mean. Don't give up too easily, because if you give up too easily, you're missing an important part of the meditation. This present moment awareness is something you can turn to at any time of the day. Whatever you're doing, you can always be present. And when you're really present, then you know the first stage of mindfulness. What is mindfulness? It's awareness of what's happening now. If it's of the past, you know, or the future, as many of you have heard me teach before, the future is uncertain. You don't know what's going to happen, and the past is uncertain as well. You think, what did you have for lunch today? Are you sure you ate that for lunch? Sometimes our memory fails us and it's not quite true what we did. We think we did it, but we didn't. That's why the past is as uncertain as the future. We just don't know. There's this great experiment which was done by a psychologist who was retiring in Canada. He'd done his first piece of work in the United States some 30 years previously, where he'd investigated young people in a school in the US. He'd asked these children, maybe about 10 or 11 years of age, simple questions about their home life. Questions such as, do you love your father more than your mother, or your mother more than your father? Are you happy at home? When you make a mistake, does your parents give you corporal punishment, or do they send you to the room? What do they do? Simple black and white questions. And he had all the question sheets filed away. And when he was cleaning out those files, he thought, would it be a wonderful experiment to find as many of those children as he could and ask them the same questions to see whether their memory of their home life 30 years previously coincided with what they wrote at the time. And he managed to trace about 60 of those children and give them the same questionnaire. When you were about 10 and 11, did you love your mother more than your father, or your father more than your mother? Were you happy at home? Did your parents spank you when you did a mistake, or did they send you to your room? And he was astounded just how the results did not correlate at all. Simple questions like, you know, did your parents punish you with a spanking or did they not? People said yes they did, now said they didn't. People said they didn't, now said they did. Did you love your mother more than your father? They said, yeah, well, I love my mum more. Now they said, no, I love my father more. And it was quite significant just how their memories of their childhood were so out of line with their actual experience at the time. It's actually showing just how memory fails us. We just don't know what happened. Even just a memory just of a short while ago. Any policeman will tell you, you may see a road accident, you may be a witness, and they ask you, was it a white car or a red car? Some of the people say it's a white car, some will say it's a red car, some will say it swerved to the left, and the other witness will say it swerved to the right. Witness statements are notoriously inconsistent. Even recently, there was a case where the US were training their Marines to withstand interrogation by the enemy. So they were subjecting them to a mock interrogation. They got some of these tough drill sergeants to stand in front of these Marines and to harangue them for 2 or 3 hours. You know, to really to try, without using physical violence, to give them some experience of what a real interrogation would be like by an enemy. Really hard. The next day, a couple of psychologists said, now who was that person interrogating you? And they did a lineup of suspects, just like in a police lineup. The real interrogator was there. It was only 24 hours before in a traumatic situation. I think they had only about 30% success rate of picking out the interrogator. Most times they got it wrong. Even one day before, in a traumatic experience which you think you'll never forget, they got it wrong. So much for memory. That's why the past is just so uncertain, it's a waste of time thinking about it. What happened to you when you were young? Did that really happen? You think it did? Can't really tell. It's gone, it's finished. Even things which you think are absolutely certain. One of the things which I am certain that it was me. I'm certain I had German measles when I was young. My brother says, no, I had German measles. So we had this argument, who had this German measles? And I asked my mother, in front of my brother, and she said, one of you did, but I can't remember which. Both of us are absolutely certain. He says, what happens with memory? It's completely untrustworthy. That's why the past is best to leave alone. Why bother thinking about it or working with it? It's all gone. So that way, that when the past is gone and the future is gone, then what you're left with is now. It's a much healthier place to live in, the present moment. So that's what you know what the present moment is, just now. Once you get used to that, you investigate it, you become familiar with it, you know it. Just like those of you who come here for the first time, when you first walked in here, you didn't know where the toilets were, you didn't know where the garden was, you didn't know where the interview room was, you didn't know where the kitchen was. Now you've been here for 2 or 3 days, you know where everything is. You've walked around, you're familiar, even if the lights go out, you probably find your way back to your room without any problem. It just takes a while to get used to the environment, to know these places. And then you know them, you're familiar with them, you can always find your way back to your room. So once you know what the present moment is, you can always find your way back there. So just keep on going. Yes? Go on, question?
Okay.
When you do the recollection of the past, you mean past lives?
Yeah.
That's a different type of memory. That's why it's really fascinating, because at that time, you can actually get experiences from a long time ago, but you're reliving them. It's not the same as actually just the ordinary memory. So it's a different type of memory. Yeah.
How would you know though that your mind isn't playing the same tricks as you just described?
Because the type of memory is completely different. If you get a memory like of a past life or an early life, it's very different than you remembering sort of what you did yesterday. Just the quality of it, it's a completely different animal, species. And the thing with, it's a fascinating part of remembering past lives, it's quite shocking at the time, but you'll know that's true. There'll be absolutely no doubt at all that was you at the time. If there's a slight bit of doubt, it's not really an authentic past life experience. It always comes with this amazing certainty, which is absent when you have a memory of what happened earlier today. It's a different sort of attribute which comes with the true past life. I can't actually explain much more than that, but I know if I can remember what I did this morning, and you do that memory from a deep meditation, completely different. That's why we call it memory, just because you're recalling something from a past life. Perhaps it should have a different name than the usual thing we term by the word memory. It's a reliving, a re-experiencing. Before I start getting deeper into Buddhism, before I started attending your talks and retreats, I was quite an ambitious and a career-minded person. I'm well recognised by my bosses and do well at my work. I'm still doing well at my work, but the career-motivated ambition is much reduced. Pressures, deadlines, challenging, etc. at work all seem so unnecessary in life. Noting that these things used to charge me up, but now seems so hollow. In the meditative, the Buddha said to be contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. It can be quite contrary, because if I had not climbed the corporate ladder, I probably would not have the opportunity or means to be more involved in Buddhism now. It also takes more than courage to totally change one's materially fulfilled lifestyle now, including support of family and kids. To take the plunge. Kindly advise the middle way for a layperson, thank you very much. Usually that if one practices this type of meditation, that one can still work very hard. But instead of like the ambition for personal wealth, this sort of the what motivates you changes. And it's not so much what I want, it may be because of my family, for my children. Or it may be just so I can make good merit by helping out Buddhist societies and communities. But whatever it is, one can still work hard, but it's not such a self-centered motivation. Not only that, but because that one can meditate, one can deal with the stresses of the corporate world. I think it's well known, certainly in Australia and the United States as well, that so many executives are being taught meditation, especially mindfulness practices, because the bosses realise that it reduces their stress. When it reduces their stress, not only do they live much longer, but they don't make so many errors in their decision making. So because of that, learning how to meditate is not sort of a negative to your career path, but it's actually a positive. I heard this from one of our monks in England, in the United States. One of their disciples applied for a job, a high stress job, and at the interview they just happened to mention that they meditated. What? You meditated? You've got the job. Because they knew they could handle stress. Which is obviously that if you don't know how to handle stress in the corporate world, you'll mess up. Just one little mistake can cost millions of dollars and sometimes hundreds of jobs. But when you have that clear mind, you can do a lot. You can be more efficient than the ordinary Joe. And I have climbed the corporate ladder, CEO of the Buddhist Society and a few others as well. And I do a lot of work. The pressures, what I have to do is quite large. It's only the meditation can show you how to focus. And so when you've finished, you can let go. You can relax. And you can recover very quickly. So this learning this meditation, learning Buddhism, actually should enhance the work. You'll be able to be more efficient, be able to get more done. without getting angry. Be more alert to see deeper into the problem so you can solve them more fast. So everything which you do in this meditation should give you more mental energy to equip you. The only thing which changes is your motivation. Your abilities are enhanced. The motivation might change. It's not just to make money for yourself. It's to do it for the benefit of other beings. I forget who wrote an article recently, but somebody wrote an article about wealth in Buddhism. There's nothing wrong with being wealthy as a Buddhist, as long as it's got by appropriate means, by good karma, by right livelihood. Because with that wealth, you can not just make yourself happy, your family happy, but you can actually serve society by helping society, setting up foundations, doing philanthropy, charity. And also, you can actually, because of your hard work, you can give employment to many, many people so that they can help others, or they can help their family. So the Buddha was saying there's nothing wrong with being wealth as long as it's properly gained. Through hard work, through intelligence, and through your good karma. But when you have it, you should use it well. So that you may have a materially fulfilled lifestyle, but you've given all those materials not just for your own enjoyment, but for the responsibility to use that wealth to help others as well. Is that okay? You know what I said before? Somebody reminded me of this because they said, oh, upstairs was very hot today. And I say, yeah, upstairs, if you're in one of the upper rooms, it's very, very hot. But if you're in one of the lower rooms, when people turn on the taps, you can hear it downstairs. And sometimes, especially if they turn the tap on at 2 o'clock in the morning, then you wake up, or 3 o'clock. So if you live downstairs, you've got sort of downstairs suffering. If you live upstairs, you don't have the sound of the taps disturbing, you have the heat, you have upstairs suffering. Wherever you live, you know, whatever sort of room you've got in this complex here, nowhere's perfect. You may think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to be downstairs and be nice and cool. Yeah, it is cool down there. You keep getting woken up at all hours because somebody turns on the tap. So, it's wherever you are, is suffering. And it's the same rich people. Rich people have rich people suffering. And it's a lot of burden having lots of money. You have to sort of look in the stocks and shares every day. Is my stocks going up? Is it going down? It's a lot of worry. When you haven't got any money, you don't have to look at the business pages. You can, all you need to do is, if you're a monk, all you do is look at the comics. But if you're poor, you've got poor persons suffering. So it doesn't really matter. Poor people have got poor people suffering. Rich people have got rich people suffering. So just whatever you... If you've got rightly earned wealth, then make use of it. Be wise. It's a burden, it's suffering to be wealthy. Don't think it's... No, oh, wouldn't it be nice to be wealthy? And if you're medium, in the middle, you've got middle people suffering. If you're poor, you've got poor people suffering. If you're a monk, you've got monks suffering. If you're a nun, you've got nuns suffering. Isn't that right, just know that? If you're a lay person, you've got lay people suffering. If you're a cook, you've got cooks suffering. You know, we've all got our own type of suffering. And think, oh, if only I could, I'm an Anagarika. Once I become a nun, then I'll be okay. You've got Anagarika suffering. When you become a nun, you'll have nun suffering. And when you're a young nun, you think, oh, when I become the boss, I can do whatever I like. Then you get bosses suffering. So just exchanging one type of suffering for another. So it's okay to be wealthy, it's okay to be poor. Whatever comes, it's how you make use of it is the most important thing. So your motivation, when you become to Buddhism, changes. Not your effort, your ability needs to increase so you can actually do more for more people. That make sense? Okay, next question. Two-part question. Is it possible to contact beings in other realms of existence, for example, ghosts, via technology versus spiritual development? And do you think that we can use their technology, nature, in our realm? Example, harnessing fine material form to create anti-gravity machines. My goodness, someone's really into the meditation, aren't they? I think you stumped me this one. It is possible to contact beings in other realms, but via technology. I don't know about that. I know that sometimes, that was always interesting, psychic phenomena. Sometimes actually people, they used to play these blank tapes, leave them going, and sometimes they get these recordings of like messages and ghosts. Sometimes that, you know, you have to turn up the volume quite a lot, but sometimes you get some messages there. It's very interesting. But I think we can use that technology, nature, and our realm from anti-gravity machines. Know about that. But they got, and that, just to tell you, just to make it some fun, I was just telling some people the other day about a couple of ghosts which we have in Perth. There's one ghost, this is a couple, Thai couple, who bought a new house over in, where is it? Not Calcutta, it's, I keep forgetting the name, I'll remember the name in a few moments. They bought a new house, and of course the real estate agent never told them that the previous owner, when he was moving his furniture out, had a heart attack right in front of the door because he was carrying too much heavy furniture. He died in front of the door. And he's still there. And because he rings the bell trying to get into the house. And it's not kids. It's the bell rings, there's no one outside. Was that suburb just to the north east of Nolamara? Begins with a, so no, a bit north of Dainela. No, just a bit north of Mirrabooka. Sorry? Balajura, that's it. In Balajura suburb. And anyway, so they're getting, it's only just being like naughty, but it was being irritating. This doorbell would keep on going again and again and again. And so the husband had this brilliant idea, this insight, the brainwave. Let's take the batteries out. And then, you know, no one can ring the doorbell. But that doesn't stop this ghost. Even without any batteries, the doorbell still goes dring, 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 dring. We found that ghosts have their own batteries. So that's ghost technology. I don't know how you can harness that. But this other fellow in another house here in Perth, I don't know which suburb this is, but it's somewhere in the south of the river, they'll watch the TV every now and again. They're watching the TV at home and the channel flips to another channel, and so they use the remote and they turn it back again. As soon as they turn it back, it flips back again. There's a ghost in that house who likes watching the TV. And that ghost watches its own channel. And it doesn't matter what you do, you can flip, 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 the ghost will always turn it back to the channel it wants to read. Listen to. The ghost also has no remote control built in. Whatever it wants to see, it flips to that channel. There's two stories about the technology of ghosts. So if you've got a ghost and it's your friend, you can harness it. You can actually, whatever channel you and the ghost decide upon, doesn't matter, your kids, they may have all the remote controls, they may hide them, you can get your own way. The ghost can override the remote control. Yeah? Oh, there's another animal ghost story. This was told recently. This is a great little story. There was one of the people who comes to Nolamara most Friday nights. She lived alone, but she had a dog. And you know that people, actually, sometimes their dog is like your child? And they love that dog, you know, hugely. And just before the dog died, he was taking the dog for a walk up in some sort of park, and she lost her finger ring. And she looked everywhere for that finger ring on the wall, couldn't find it at all. So she gave it up for lost. A couple of days later, the dog died. She was very, very sad. She forgot all about the ring. But She heard this dog barking in the house many, many times. Now you think that might be imagination, but if you've lived with a dog for many, many years, you know the sound of your dog's bark. You recognize it straight away, and that was her dog. 3 or 4 days later, after it died, she heard it barking in front of the front door, just outside. So she went to open it. On the mat in front of the door was her ring. The dog had found her lost ring and put it down in front of the front door, barked, so she could find her lost ring. So there are ghost animals, and they can help you. Yeah.
In one of the talks you gave that's online, you talk about ghosts being made of fine material so they can essentially have different characteristics and feet. So you said their feet don't touch the ground when they walk. It's one of the characteristics. How can, and you may not know the answer to this, but how can something in the fine material realm interact with something in ours, and especially since you have a science background? Do you have any clue about that?
Okay, how can someone in a fine material realm interact with our realm? It's just by the power of will. The mind is so strong. The mind can do things. You can move things with the power of the mind. What's it called? Psychokinesis or something. You can do things like that. It's possible. Because the mind is very, very strong. The mind, the Buddha said, is a forerunner of all things. I know you actually asked, and you could come in to talk about psychic powers one day. We might do that later on. But yeah, so the ghost can sometimes do those things, can move things. That's why one of the characteristics of ghosts, especially if they're the naughty ghosts, is they throw things at you. It's not that uncommon in like real hauntings, so things go flying through the room. But there's one thing which has been found, and this was by the London Psychic Research Society. Because I was at Cambridge when they celebrated their 100th anniversary. I was a member of their society. And they published all these reports. And one of the things I always remembered, 100 years of hunting ghosts in England, and there's heaps of ghosts in England, they're famous for their ghosts. And they found that even though these objects would be thrown around the room, never once did they hit anybody. The ghost's aim was so good, we'll always miss. It was one of the laws, the rules. So, they think the ghost could actually move things around the room, but they would never hit anybody. And there was no one actually knew why, but that was what the evidence had shown. And one of my close mates at Cambridge, he was, he used to have this lovely business card, and it's called Tony Cornell, he was. And he had this lovely business card on the Ghost Hunting Council of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. It was a great business card. He was one of the chief ghost hunters. And when last time I went to the UK, I had lunch with him, and he was just about to retire. And he was telling me about all of his experiences, a whole lifetime devoted to hunting ghosts in the UK. I mean, every now and again, I used to see a Sunday paper here in Perth, and it was some article about some haunting. He'd always write the article because he was the expert. He was a close friend of mine. The ghost expert in England. And he said that sometimes, many times, he'd been in rooms and things flying all over the place. And he doesn't make these things up. He was a personal friend of mine. He said, never once would they hit you. Why? He doesn't know, but they never would hit.
Do they do anything as a result? I mean, do you just do anything to help them move on, or you just
like, yeah.
Oh, that wasn't really the house,
and you
never look at
them. That's right. It's best you should keep a ghost. They're really helpful. It's nice to have a ghost around because they can actually kick the burglars out. Sometimes they do that. So ghosts can be sort of quite useful, but if you really want to get them to move on, loving kindness and sharing of merits. That's what one does. But we'll talk about that later, because otherwise we won't finish these questions. Oh my goodness, someone else. This must be... I just picked up this question next. How is psychic powers developed? Is it from past lives? In the Buddhist stories, there are monks who can fly. The Buddha in the Angulimala story can't be caught. These seem just myths. There seem no relevance for us. same for holy places and relics. Some say it's a must for Buddhists to visit holy places or visit the relics. Can that add to our good karma? Yeah, it does. Actually, these weird things happen in life sometimes. There are things like psychic powers with relics. But every now and again, if you have some good relics and you practice well, the relics increase. They just more appear. And how many have you got? Is it two or three more this year? Nice retreat. Two more, okay. And then the Buddhist Fellowship, they just got some relics when they first got them, and think they got an extra one, just suddenly appeared. You know, anything all closed up, you count them as two there, now there's three there. And I've seen that many times happening. Just relics just increase. Sometimes if you misbehave, they disappear. So that's a small psychic phenomena. But holy places, if you ever go to those holy places and you've got a little bit of sensitivity, you can meditate. I guarantee your meditation will be deeper in those holy places. And you've got power there. You just sit in those power places and you feel it, just get so inspired. And it's easy to meditate. So there is special things happen at those places. You just need to be sensitive, that's all. Now I speak as a theoretical physicist. You don't sort of make these things up, but you see them, you look at the evidence, and yeah, it's true. A relic is supposed to be these little things which are supposed to be relics of the Buddha, like bone relics or hair relics, come from the Buddha. And there was, from the very early time, the Buddha said that after his cremation, to put the relics aside in different places, in like usually in his big called stupas or chedis, and so many amazing things happen around those, as you see it happen. So you know, there is something there, but that's another story, another time. Andrew Brown, thank you very much for your patient, loving teaching. I have stopped thinking. How could you write this letter then? It's I'm doing instead. My mind is still beautiful at last. But how do you watch the middle of the breath? Many blessings. If your mind is still beautiful, well done. Don't do anything else. Just stay with that. So sometimes when we get to a stage in meditation, we think, oh great, what next? That's missing the point. Stay where you are. Stay in that place and you'll develop the next stage quite naturally. You don't move, you stay still. Wherever you are, the next stage is right within the one you're in now. So you just have to stay with this, whatever it is. If it's still and beautiful, congratulations, stay there. And the next stage will come in its own time. It's like a fruit on a tree. You can't make it sort of ripen. You just have to wait until it ripens according to its nature. And then the next fruit comes. So, still a beautiful, marvellous. Stay there and enjoy it. And it will develop by itself. Dear Ajahn Brahm, all that you've talked about over the last 2 days, present moment awareness, watching the breath, looking inwards, etc., how do you apply these to walking meditation? What is the proper way to do walking meditation? There's another one about walking meditation. I'll say that now then. When you're doing walking meditation, you can actually find a little path, walk backwards and forwards, because that means you don't have to think too much where you're going to go to next. So if you're just walking back and forth, it means that you don't have too much to think about. Put your eyes and look about 2 meters in front of you so that you're not looking to the left and right, you're not distracting yourself, you can see where you're going to walk soon. So if there's a twig there or a branch or a snake or something, you're going to miss it. There's no snakes here, but you just look just in case. And first of all, you develop present moment awareness, just being now. So you're walking just one step at a time. You're not looking where you're going to go to in 3 or 4 steps in the future. You're not worrying where you've come from. Just the present moment, just now. All the past has disappeared, all the future, who cares? You're just in the moment, enjoying this one step. Present moment awareness first. When you're in the present moment, past and future have disappeared, then No thinking. Get into silence. So you're walking without a commentary. Just silently, just being in the moment, just making this one step without having a commentary inside. So it's silence. After silence, then you can actually start focusing on your feet moving, whether it's the left foot or the right foot. Exactly the same way you know whether you're breathing in, you're breathing out. How do you know whether you're walking? Just ask yourself, am I walking with my left foot? Am I walking with my right foot? How do I know? Whatever tells you that your left foot is moving, that's what you watch. Whatever tells you your right foot is moving, that's what you watch. And then the next stage is fill your whole mind with the movement of the feet. So you see the very beginning of a left foot moving when it just lifts above the ground until the very end, the last movement of the foot before it, you move the other foot. So you fill your whole mind with the movement of the feet. Usually that's all the furthest I go, but really I should start to say after that, go to the beautiful foot, like the beautiful breath, or rather the beautiful step, until it gets just so lovely just watching this foot moving. Oh, it's just so delightful. The next one, oh, it's just so wonderful, just feeling all this movement of the body going forward. So it's a beautiful walking. Yeah?
Just the breath follow the step or just natural?
Natural, yeah, just leave the breath alone. The other way, if you don't like that, which I mentioned today at the interviews, is that you can do just see what happens walking meditation. For that, I just take one step, I don't know where I'm going to end up, I have got no plans at all what my next step's going to do, whether it's going to go to the left or the right or straight ahead or backwards. Just I walk without any plans. Complete present moment awareness and see where I end up. Got no plan where I'm going to walk to, always in the present moment, silent, seeing what happens. That's good fun. You know where you're going to end up.
It's like a robot sometimes, like there's nothing there.
You are a robot.
And you switch off and just stop, like.
Yeah.
It's like the mind, to me it shows me how the materiality and the mentality and the minute I switch off. Maybe the body is more like if I keep my foot up and I don't intend to put it on, it stays there.
Yeah.
So it's...
You are a robot. Non-self, you're completely conditioned. So you might as well accept it. It makes life much. Because when you're a robot, you've got no one to complain about. Why feel guilty? It's just your program, that's all. Whatever program, you made a mistake.
I just wanted to ask you that question in the interview, what was the purpose of doing that? Because, like,
you get still.
Thinking, it's like all the elements working too, like, it gets heavy, then it gets light.
Well, it is just cause and effect, that's all. Put the causes, now you get the effect. But one thing is, you get still, you get peaceful. With that stillness, you get more insight. So you're slowing down. The other way of doing walking meditations is Ajahn Chitamro's invention. It actually comes from a Thai teacher. When you move your left foot, you can say a mantra to yourself. This is your mantras. When you move your left foot, your mantra is, I will die. When you move your right foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And don't change for about half an hour. Every left foot move, I will die. Right foot, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die. First of all, you think it's silly, but you carry on doing it. Then someone inside you listens. I will die, that's for sure. Hey, that's true. I will die, that's for sure. Then it gets spooky. I will die, that's for sure. And then after you go through the fear, you get this marvelous release. I will die, that's for sure. You're letting go of attachments. You know it's true, so why are you attached to anything? Why do you want to get into deep meditation? Why do you want to get anything? I will die, that's for sure. So that's another fun way of meditating. People have some great results in that. They really get into it, but you've got to be consistent. Every breath, don't change. At least minimum half an hour or an hour. I will die, that's for sure. 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 And that's, you know, after a while, the, you know, the penny drops.
I hypnotize you to die.
Well, that's okay, because if you die on a retreat, it's wonderful, good karma. And I'll give you a cup price funeral. You came from Melbourne, didn't you? Adelaide. Okay, well, it's much cheaper to send the ashes back. We can cash in your ticket and make a donation. So it's much easier, and you don't have all that problem with your family. You know, just imagine what it's like getting old in an old people's home, getting sick. You know, you can't even just go to the toilet. You have to have somebody wipe your backside. Do you really want to do that? So I will die. I will die. That's for sure. The thing is, we don't know when. How much effort is right effort? When does compassion for body and mind become an excuse for lack of effort and laziness? What is right effort? Right effort is whatever it takes to lessen unwholesome states, to avoid unwholesome states in the first place, whatever it takes to arouse good states and to maintain those good states. Right effort, according to the Buddha, is measured by its results. That's why people only think that right effort is being tough. What's the result of being tough? You get stressed. Though that cannot be right effort. As I mentioned already, that right effort is more wisdom power than willpower. Wisdom power, not willpower. Because willpower is just you get strong will. I'm going to do this. I'm going to sit. I'm going to get a chance this evening. I'm going to do it. Look who I am. I'm tough. You know that one of the stories of my very first Waisak ceremony, my first year at Cambridge. I went to this Waisak ceremony and I had some monks come from London. And I was so inspired, especially when you heard this story about the Buddha's enlightenment. Many of you know that story. He sat under the Bodhi tree and he made this earth-shattering determination, even though my blood might dry up, even though my bones might turn to dust, I will not move from this seat until I have got complete and utter enlightenment. Wow, I thought. So my maximum meditation was about 20 minutes. That was pushing. So I went back to my room in my cottage and I sat down. I did. I sat down on the seat and I said in all solemnity, right, this is it. If the Buddha could do it, so could I. You know, I went to Cambridge. I was intelligent. If he could do it, he's only an Indian. He's still right, you're only young. So I thought, right, this is it. And I made a determination. Even though my blood will dry up, my bones turn to dust, I am not going to move no matter what. So I sat down, I think about 35 minutes I lasted. And I was in absolute agony. Not peaceful at all. And of course I opened my eyes and I was really disappointed for two reasons. One, I wasn't enlightened. Number two, my blood and my bones were still as they were when I started. So I realised, you know, that willpower is not enough. It's so stupid. Wisdom power is what's necessary. Because you can be tough and have the strongest willpower in the world, but you still don't get enlightened. That's not the way. Wisdom power. Wholesome states and unwholesome states. What does that mean? Peace, joy, the inner happiness. Some people still think that happiness, all happiness, is sometimes a bad state. You've got to get rid of happiness. Too many teachers go along and say, if you're having happiness in a meditation, get rid of it, you'll get attached. Please never listen to those teachings. The Buddha said, and I've quoted this so many times, in so many suttas, like the simile of the quail, Latuti Kopama Sutta. I said it the other day in the Nirvana Wibhanga Sutta in Nolamara. the happiness of deep meditation, the joy, is to be followed, to be cultivated, to be developed. It is not to be feared, said the Buddha. I even say it in Pali. Asa vittabhang, bhavetabhang, bhahurikatabhang, labhayitabhang. So when you get happiness, that's a wholesome state. Get into it. Cultivate it. Don't try and get rid of it. If you're enjoying yourself in the meditation, you're supposed to be enjoying yourself. Enjoy it. Get into it. Don't throw it away. Don't be afraid, oh, I'm enjoying myself too much. This can't be right. It is right. So you have to know what the wholesome states are and what the unwholesome states are. Sometimes you have pain and people think, oh, pain must be good. You can learn a lot from pain, you know. No pain, no gain. But look what the Buddha said, his first teaching. That's not the middle way. He said, to avoid the pain in the body, to avoid indulgence in the five senses. In meditation, we're indulging in the sixth sense, which is not part of the two extremes. So once you understand what these wholesome states, then you understand what is right effort, whatever arouses those wholesome states. That's why, to me, that story I gave of my six reins, I said that in the first night here. I was trying so hard, putting effort, and it wasn't working. My unwholesome states were increasing. I was getting more crazy, more fantasies, more thoughts of sex and romance as a monk, 6 years as a monk. I was trying with effort, but it was wrong effort, it wasn't wise effort. So I sat, went and made that resolution from 3 to 4, you can think whatever you want. I let go, and then it was peaceful. That was right effort. Because it got rid of all the unwholesome states, and it started generating good states. Kindness is right effort. Why? Because if you have kindness, if you generate compassion, what's the result of that inside of you? You feel peace, you feel joy, the mindfulness increases, the alertness comes. That is wholesome states. Compassion, letting go, peace, contentment, they lead to wholesome states. The first five ascetics, five disciples of the Buddha, didn't understand that also. They looked at the Buddha and think, you know, you're getting slack. Look at you, you're eating. And so they abandoned the Bodhisattva just before he became enlightened. They thought, you've given up the effort. But the Buddha said, no, this is right effort. The middle way. Using wisdom power. Then you know what right effort is. Great question. When my mind becomes peaceful and relaxed and everything starts to fall away, I become afraid. How I don't go beyond fear. Fear is a great sign. Whoever wrote that question, well done, you're getting somewhere. What is fear? Fear is your challenging your attachments. Fear is always the seeing that something which is very close to you has been taken away. You're about to lose something which is very close and dear to you. What fear is. Great, you're on the point of finding out another attachment and overcoming it. Fear is part of the path of meditation. When fear comes up, oh great, I'm seeing an attachment now. And how do you overcome fear? You just have a little bit of courage, just go a bit deeper, have faith, a bit of confidence, and I'm going to go and find out what I'm afraid of. You just let it go of something which doesn't belong to you. It's much better you get rid of it now. Like I was saying, much better you die today than you put it off till later. It could happen anyway, might as well get it over and done with before you have to suffer too much old age and sickness and pain and be a burden on other people and have all these hospital bills and my goodness me. So while you're afraid of death, the sooner the better. That's why I encourage people to eat a lot of junk food. No, I don't encourage that, I'm just saying that. But the point is that when we're afraid of something, it's an attachment. Something which we think belongs to us is being taken away, like our body. That's the fear of death. When we realise this body doesn't belong to us, there's no problem anymore. We have no fear. As you go deep in meditation, what you're losing is your sense of control. First of all, you lose your body. And because we're attached to our body, when the body starts to disappear, we say, ah! If I'm not aware of my body, something might go wrong. You want that awareness because that's our protection, so that nothing can harm us. If a ghost comes, what are you afraid of? What can a ghost do to you? If a devil comes, because when I grew up, the very scariest thing, because it was a Christian culture, the most terrifying thing was a devil come to take your soul. I've come to take over your mind. The devil came and said, Ajahn Brahm, I've come to take over your mind. I would say, you can have it. It's not mine anyway. Here you go. Because it's not mine, there's nothing there to take over. But if it's yours, you're afraid of somebody taking it away. What you're attached to. Imagine your house with all of your loved ones and all of your possessions in there. Suppose when you got in front of your house, it was a fire. It was blazing. And you only had a chance to rush in and get one thing, what would you get? What would you get in your house? And that's your biggest attachment. What would be the second thing you get? That's your second biggest attachment. You understand what attachments are? Sometimes people rush into the house and they kill themselves. Because of attachments. And these are the things which we let go of. First of all, it's scary. Because we define ourselves by what we own, by relations, who we love. That becomes us. What we're really letting go of is our sense of self. When our body disappears, much of what we thought we owned is gone. That's only the start of letting go. Then you let go of your control. The doer disappears. Will vanishes, and that's scary. You're not in control anymore. No, nothing's in control. The potential to form an action to will is gone in deep meditation. In second jhana, the potential to do is vanished. You're stuck. As you go deep into the jhanas, the knowing, consciousness disappears. Your last refuge of a me. At least we think I'm the one who knows. That vanishes. And that can be very scary. Ah, there's nothing left. Indeed, there's nothing left. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. Well, we'll talk about that next one. Worrying about feeling starved in the evening, I piled my plate at lunch yesterday, stuffed myself silly and suffered from a bloated stomach. I eat less today. I'm amazed at the variety of food provided and see a bottle of espresso too. Isn't stimulating food bad for meditation, or is it just mind over matter, so whatever food you consume does not matter really? P.S. I'm not complaining about the food, many thanks to kind people who provide and cook for us. So it doesn't really matter. If you get the worst possible food, and I've had the worst possible food, and you can still be greedy over boiled frogs. I said the other day, you know that story I had of a boiled frog on rice? Actually, I recalled that that's actually the abbot got the first choice of the frog, so he got the biggest one. When it came down to me, the frog I got was this scrawny one. So I was even greedy about a frog. Let alone all the food we have here. It doesn't matter how much you have. You can be greedy, you can stuff yourself with frog and rice. So the point is that there's a food for you. Use it wisely. You've had an insight there. Eating too much, you get a bloated stomach and you don't get any happiness. If you follow craving rather than wisdom, then you just get suffering. So just be content to eat the right amount. Don't follow the craving. This is good enough. And don't have fear. Just don't think about the future. Present moment is enough. This is enough for now. Who cares about the evening? The evening comes, sometimes you don't even think about it. And you're just quite happy. So, eat less today. Very good. See what happens tomorrow. Next question. Ajahn, are we allowed to go jog on the grass in the garden? I don't see why not. As long as you do it mindfully, don't go too fast. See what happens. You can jog if you want. Dear Ajahn, can mindfulness chanting Buddha or Amitabha, the D word, that's death I suppose, or this word, lead a person into samadhi state? We can even start with doing some chanting, but once the chanting has done its job, in other words, that you've got reasonably quiet, then be quiet. Don't do any more chanting. I've already said one mantra, I will die, this, that's for sure, I will die, that's for sure, which is a great one to do. But once that's done its job, then be quiet. You contemplate death. But my favourite mantra, which many of you have heard before, two little words. When you're meditating, on the in-breath you say shut, and the out-breath up. Shut, up. Shut, up. Shut, up. When you do shut up, you don't need to say the word anymore. It's done. It's done for sure. Here we go. At the meditation hall today at 7 p.m. I was able to zoom in and felt my heart beating. I must be doing wrong because it could not be that simple, isn't it? Ajahn. Okay, you can zoom, you can feel your heart beating, but the heart's not a very good object of meditation. Because if you calm that down and it stops, you'll be in trouble. I take no responsibility. Because the heart is just, it's not a very calm thing. With the breath, it can actually stop very easily. It's a much more soothing thing to actually to calm the breath down and watch the heart. So leave the heart alone. Don't watch the heart. Just put your effort on the breath. Ajahn, unfortunately, I'm unable to achieve this in the meditation room. Why? Is this the same question? Must be. Oh, you've got three parts. Hang on. You've got three questions here. That's being unfair. That's number four part. That's got number two part. That's number one part. My goodness. It's not a question, it's a book. Dive in retreat on day one, Saturday. I familiarised myself with the place so as to feel like home. Take a walk a few times around the place, especially the garden, beautiful garden, especially in the early morning and evening. Adjusted my body to two meals a day. Early sleeping time, etc. No meditation, just close my eyes, relax and clear mind. Great! You did nothing. It's called emptiness. Doing emptiness. Nothing. Woke up at 3:30 and took a bath, drink hot water and I'm set. The garden in the early morning is dazzling with inspiration. Now it's like it up. Took a walk, chose a good spot. It's not really a question, it's like a dog. Standing, lifted my face and felt the gentle breeze blowing. Birds chirping, leaves mottling. Later at its best. Beautifully on the outside. Shut my mind off of all other thoughts. Close my eyes inside. Mind is now empty. Concentrate. See with the mind. Feel soft breath. Gentle patience. Very gently. Hear the heart beating very, very softly. It was bliss. Oh, great. So if it's bliss, that's fine. Whatever you get in happiness in this meditation, you're going in the correct direction. Maybe I should stress more the happiness of meditation, the joy of being free. Ajahn Chah once described it like this, like a person who's born with a rope around his neck. And on either end of the rope, there's these two big men who keep the rope taut. They're pulling it tight so he can hardly breathe. But this man has been born with that, grown up with that, lived all his life with this constricting rope around its neck. And then one day those two men, big strong men, loosen the rope a little. Oh, and he can breathe. Oh, this feels so nice. That's bliss. He can breathe for the first time. You know what those two men are called? One is called desire. The other one is called illusion.